This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined again by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have three sponsors for the show, the first being Jam Software, who provide ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies, such as Macs, iPads, iPhone, and Apple TV in education organizations. More about them at jamsoftware.com. And Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect, and review student work and provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, and more. And finally, Aerohive. Aerohive unleashes the power of enterprise mobility. Aerohive's technology enables organizations of all sizes to use mobility to increase productivity, engage customers, and grow their business. And I'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. Bradley, how are you?
Fantastic. I am coming back from the stomach bug. It's always a blast.
Okay. Yep. It's good to get that out of the way before... you're on holiday next week, are you? We're on holiday next week, which is awesome.
We are. Part of the week, today is Wednesday the 11th, so we have a half day the 12th, and we're out for President's Day. So it's basically celebrating Abraham Lincoln and George Washington's birthday.
We don't celebrate those guys over here.
You get bonus points if you can tell me which presidents they were, like what numbers.
Either of them number one?
Yes.
One of them's number one, right? It's not Lincoln, so George Washington's the first president.
Yes.
Right, he's the one who has a statue like a Roman god in the Smithsonian Museum. Yeah. Not at all an overblown reputation in any way.
He could have become king had he wanted to be. Uh-huh. Of course, that would have defeated the whole point of, you know.
King of the U.S. or King of Britain?
King over the U.S. He basically had to be like, I'm not going to be president anymore. I'm obviously, this is like ancient history, but which if he had become king of the U.S., that would really defeat the purpose of, you know, the whole Declaration of Independence sort of thing. But yeah, Lincoln was the 16th president of the United States of America. So, yeah, so we're out. So we'll be back in Tuesday. We call it winter break.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so, I think I know I always find that this holiday is the one I appreciate the most, you know, even though we had the holiday not that long ago, you know, February, the darkness in Scotland, the whole bit, you know. I always look forward to this break more than any other.
Yeah, we get a break here, then we get spring break in March, and then it's a long lull until the end of school. Of course, anybody listening that doesn't work in education is rolling their eyes about this point.
And we see the amount of effort we have to go through, Bradley, just to organize all these holidays. It's terrible.
It is. It's very
a lot
very
of effort. It really is.
Yeah. Well, I was traveling last week, and if it could have happened bad at home, it did. But one of my kids had the stomach bug, which started this whole fiasco, and then the other one had to get stitches. Oh, so my wife said I would not be traveling anyhow.
It's your fault.
Yes. Cool. So, interesting news from the folks at Paper, great app that we've talked about for a long, long time, no more in-app purchase.
Yeah, they've moved completely over. They've basically made the whole app free, right? And I think maybe a year ago, would it be right to say that they brought out the stylus, which they call the pencil. So they have paper and pencil, which is very cute. And I guess, you know, partly they've got a whole ton of VC money behind them. I think A16Z are one of their investors, perhaps. But also, I guess they're depending or they're betting the farm on sales of the stylus, one of which was actually to me recently. I bought one. They now have distribution in the Apple Store. This is how I ended up buying it. Was I was in the Apple Store on Regent Street in London when I was down recently, and I saw that they had the retail package of the 53 pencil on the shelf, so I picked up the black aluminium one. They also had there's a kind of wooden one, which I think is £10 more expensive, but they didn't have any of those in the store at the time. So I got the black aluminium one, which is absolutely a lovely thing. And I've been playing around with that a little bit. I can't draw in any sense, but I kind of like it as a note-taking app.
Well, I think they really have a nice niche here that, you know, it's conceivable that entire art classes could buy that. You know, they could sell 50 of those to one school.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Before, they had no option because there was no way to unlock all the brushes.
Yeah, no, that was always the difficulty. And we certainly never deployed their app because of that. But I was... We've used other apps such as ArtRage and also Procreate, our two apps that are really popular in our school in the art department. And I've shown them Paper by 53 before, but it hasn't really taken off in the same way. I think it's that bit more stylized than some of those other apps, which try to be very realistic recreations of what you would do with art materials. Paper by 53 is that bit more stylized and a little bit more impressionistic, perhaps. But I like working with it with the stylus, and I like how it's not trying to be a biro pen, you know. And that's the kind of in some ways that's the charm of the whole app, is that it's not trying to be a pen; it's trying to be digital ink, if you like. Although it does kind of make traditional analogies of some of the stuff that it does. But the pen is one of the more interesting Bluetooth styluses, because it has an eraser end, and it also supports orientation as well. So you can sort of shade with the side of it, and the pencil tool will go all kind of wide and flat and everything. So that's quite interesting, and that certainly brings paper by 53 into the scope of things that you might deploy in school for art or for drawing, or even just for sketching and things like that as well.
Of course, being Bluetooth, it would be a little bit more difficult to have, you know, buy three of them and pass them around the classroom, because you're going to have to be constantly, you know, unpairing and repairing. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's certainly conceivable in iOS 9 we could see built-in hardware support for these kind of devices, which might make it interesting across even other apps. And that may be the bet that they're taking, is, hey, we're not going to be an app manufacturer, we're going to sell hardware, because mm-hmm. our hardware can work across all these apps thanks to new APIs.
Well, there certainly are. You know, most of these advanced Bluetooth styli have some kind of API that the developers ship. And there are some other apps that do support the paper stylus. I think Notability is one of them. I might be wrong on that. NoteShelf is definitely one of them, I know. And I think the problem, the Evernote stylus, the paper stylus, you know, you've got some apps support one of them, some apps support the other one. And, you know, we've said this before, that it kind of gives me the feeling that we really need to have a low-level API that supports that, and also hardware that supports it as well, which, of course, is one of these rumors that's been, you know, is floating about again, as it always has, Bradley, that there's going to be this iPad Pro, and it's going to have a big screen, it's going to have a hardware digitizer, and or a better, higher-resolution digitizer, and it's going to support a stylus. But stylus became a kind of, you know, explicit rumor over the past couple of weeks as well.
Yeah, that'll be an interesting fall, because that's one of those like high-level fruits that the average user isn't clamoring for, but you know, like the guys at Penny Arcade, they prefer drawing on the Microsoft Surface. Mm-hmm. And so those type of professions that Apple, you know, the iPad is maybe a great device for, but it's not the best device on the market. Does that explain that well, in terms of, like, yeah, you know, it works, but it's maybe not the best?
Yeah, it's workable. And to me, it's kind of amazing what people have done with the iPad, considering how unoptimized the entire hardware stack is for doing drawing on the screen. But I think that there's so much more that could be done that hasn't been done so far. And, you know, maybe that'll come.
I guess it's an admission that our finger isn't always the best.
Not always. But, you know, you'd be amazed, you know, Bradley, to see some of the artwork that our students do just using their fingers, not using a stylus at all, you know. And I show some of those in my presentations quite a lot. You know, we just did this with the finger. But what's real interesting from an educational point of view is the way that Jenny Revolta, our art teacher, does what she does. It's really fascinating to watch, because she's really looking at the iPad in art as a kind of simulator environment for traditional art media skills. You know, at the same time, she's very, I love her approach, because she looks at both sides of it, and she says, well, digital art is a medium in itself, but it can also be used as a simulator for practicing these skills in traditional media as well. And she's got great stories and great examples of students who couldn't get something right in oil paint, so she took them back to digital practice to use undo, redo, multiple versions, and then got it right there in the simulator, if you like. And then they were able to, you know, with some great teaching as well, they were able to go from doing it in the simulator to doing it on the real materials as well. And I think there's a lot of richness in technology there, you know, iPad and so on, that we haven't really tapped into yet, except in some areas like that. And I'm keen to see what we can do more of that way.
Yeah, I'm reminded back to like AutoCAD and my drafting class, where you would start out on the T-square, on the table, and learning the fundamentals before you would move to the computer, because the computer did so much for you automatically that it was important to know why and how it was doing it. Mm-hmm. Not so much of like you would be doing this if there was like a post-apocalyptic world, but you just need to, it's helpful to understand the theory behind things. Some reason we show our work in math. You need to know that you know why it's doing it, not that you can just press it into a calculator.
I think the key difference for me is that, you know, an app like ArtRage, for example, is a very faithful simulator of what you would get if you did the same thing, you know, on paper. And sometimes when you use, you know, say you used Wolfram Alpha or something in maths, you would just tap in some, you know, formulation of your information request, and then magic happens, and then you get it out the other end. And none of these tools, none of these art tools are magically drawing for you. All they're doing is providing you simulations of the tools and the materials, and then you still have to make the drawing happen. And it's very clear, you know, what I've seen in Jenny's class, that it is every bit as much of a skill to produce a digital drawing as it is to produce a paper drawing as well. And I know some people would dispute that, but then again, you know, we've said this before, you're into that weird, you know, rhetorical valley where you're kind of debating the nature of what is real and what is true. You know, is that real art? Is that real music? You know, nobody really talks about, is that real grammar if you type it in, you know, in a typewriter, but somehow it's not real art if you don't do it on physical materials. So, you know, that's another one of these leading edge challenges that I think is going to grow and grow and grow as technology gets adopted into more areas of education as well.
Before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Aerohive. Aerohive unleashes the power of enterprise mobility. They enable organizations of all size to deploy Wi-Fi to increase productivity, engage customers, and grow businesses. It's deployed in over 13,000 enterprises worldwide. They have a proprietary mobility platform that leverages a public or private cloud and a distributed Wi-Fi architecture to deliver unified, intelligent, and cost-effective networks. Again, there's no controller. You can host their management system on your own infrastructure, or they can host it for you. Big fan of Aerohive Wi-Fi. So if you're looking for Wi-Fi for state testing planning or just planning for deployments in the fall, definitely check them out. It's aerohive.com, AEROHIVE.com. So one of the things that we decided over the past 2 weeks is some changes to our lunch program, which I thought our listeners might be interested in. So to recap way we currently did lunches, and just know that I know this isn't like the most efficient way, but it's just the most efficient way that works for us. And I think most schools will know what I mean by that, mm-hmm. because you often have to, when you're making these changes, you have to play change before you can play dollars, if you understand my analogy. Mm-hmm. And so we had a couple options you could do. You could buy an annual plan for lunch, and I think that was $650. And basically, you added it to the cost of your tuition. You could pay it at one lump sum, or you could just break it out into your tuition payments. Some of our parents do 12-month payments, 10-month payments, half and half, or again, lump sum. So you had that option, or you could do a 30-day lunch pass. And basically what that involved, you were a check for, I think it was $130, and your teacher got a – your student's teacher got a card with 30 holes in it to be punched, and you wrote the kid's name on it. They're individually numbered. We kept track of who had what, because it's basically like a currency if you think about it. I always mm-hmm. joked that I would sell them on the black market. And basically when a kid would eat, they didn't have to order anything. When the kid would eat, it would punch a hole, and when they were out, they were out. Or you could order a la carte on RenWeb, and that worked out to be about $5 a meal. And The thing about it is, if you're eating more than twice a month, it was more cost-effective to buy the lunch ticket. The reason most parents didn't do it because they don't like out – I mean, you got to put out $130 in August that it might take you until May to use up. And I get that. You don't want to put out that kind of money all at once if you don't have to. I'm the same way. But RenWeb's lunch system isn't the greatest. It's a lot of work for me in terms of like adding meals. Because you basically have like a text box you enter everything in, so you have your main course and then your side dishes. Well, often the cafeteria staff will have similar courses, but they'll be like, instead of carrots, it's mashed potatoes, or instead mm-hmm. of rolls, it's toast. So I have to build all these individual meals, and it's very, very time consuming. And then it's another really a easy system for our parents to navigate. We've complained about RenWeb in the past. It's just a weird system. And I can make it work. Our parents make it work, but we have all sorts of little quirks where, you know, browser update or browser settings are wrong. It just doesn't work well. So we have a lot of parents who end up charging. They just basically don't order anything. The kids eat. We charge their RenWeb account. And so we looked at actually outsourcing our lunch program. And I know that's very, very popular around the U.S. And we looked at the numbers. We just could not make it work financially. And I think the reason is we don't have a high school. Because when you can like kind of spread that cost among the younger kids who eat less versus the older kids who eat more, it kind of works out well. We just didn't have that. And so the numbers just didn't work out. We just didn't feel like we could, you know, in doing that, everybody would, you basically get lunch included with your tuition, but we, it was going to be, I think it was close to $1,000, per student per year. Maybe it was closer to 800. So we just, it just didn't make it work. And so what we've decided to do is to actually eliminate RenWeb from this system. And on, we'll have the annual plan, we'll have a 30-day kid ticket, but we're also adding a 10-day ticket. So you take, basically take $5 times 10, it's a $50 expenditure that gets 10 lunches. And we're hoping that will basically cover those people that eat, you know, twice a month but didn't necessarily want to drop $130 on a lunch ticket. Mm. And then we're actually raising the price of charges to $6. So if you don't buy into tickets and you want to eat, you can do that. It's just going to be way more expensive. But we're not going to post those charges on RenWeb. We're going to post them in fax. So I know we've got some listeners who are fax and RenWeb customers, and fax is our tuition system, and it handles our after-school care billing. Mm-hmm. They call that fax incidentals. And we love fax. Fax, to me, is a prime example of a software solution that does one thing well. All it is tuition. You know, it's not trying to be a student management system, although they did buy RenWeb last summer. And so there is a little bit of integration there, but we're going to start posting those lunch charges on fax. And our, what we're doing here, no one will actually have to order ahead of time. We'll just get lunch counts that morning, because the lunch counts are difficult to get ahead of time anyways, because if you're on the annual plan or if you have a lunch ticket, we don't find out until that morning if you're eating or not.
Right. Because so, it's not booked ahead.
Right. You're treating it like a restaurant where you're going to have to figure out that day how much to cook. And I'm excited about eliminating the payment system, because I always thought having two payment systems was confusing. There were probably five people at our school that could tell you exactly how lunches worked and everywhere you might be charged. And I was one of them. So I was like the de facto lunch guru, not because it was like the cafeteria was my job, but because I have my hands in all of these systems and know where the pieces go. And so I'm really happy that we're simplifying that down. We'll still obviously have RenWeb for student database, but we're just saying, okay, any payment stuff, it's now in fax.
Yep. Yep. And that seems sounds like a sensible approach. I mean, whenever you've got a system where most people don't understand it, it's time to simplify something or other. It seems like a good way to go.
Well, we'd love to do like an actual cafeteria POS system. Mm-hmm. But it's just one of those things where we just aren't large enough to warrant the cost. We can do a lot of this with paper. It's other mistakes occasionally, yes, but not so much where you're losing so much money that you need to deploy another system. And that's been my biggest thing over the past 12 to 24 months when we look at things, is I am just wary of another system to manage, another separate system, another separate database. We had a company call that this week that they have like a product that where parents can submit their health records. So not having to fax them to you, bring them by. Mm-hmm. And like that sounds really cool. Like it helps automate some of that, and it's accessible online everywhere. But the problem, because right now we get the paper copies and then put that into RenWeb. But the downside is it's another system. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you know, it'd be one thing if you could do single sign-on with RenWeb, but, or if it was a module you could buy. But just not something we need that bad to warrant, you know, a whole other database.
Yeah, I think it's too often, you know, companies that want to sell, you know, some kind of SaaS dashboards to schools, they're not really thinking about like the organizational integration cost of it, you know. It's like, oh, just upload your CSV to this thing as well. You know, we were offered a thing not so long ago where it was like ebook rental for iPads, and you could rent a book for like a week for 10 pence or whatever. And it was like, well, how do I make an account on that? Oh, you just upload your CSV. You know, it's like, right, you know, that's maybe the fifth place I'm uploading my CSV to, you know, and eventually, you know, that's fine. You can make that consistent in the first week of school, but, you know, kids coming, kids going, kids leaving, kids arriving. How does that all work out? You know, and eventually it becomes a gigantic pain. I mean, I now have a sort of procedure checklist for all the things I have to update whenever a student arrives to the school, and it is not very scriptable so far. And I'm trying to think of ways I can get that to be a bit more straightforward, but it's not easy so far.
Yeah, we are in the same boat, because we had a new student last week, and you're thinking, okay, where do I need to set her up at? And it is confusing, because then when it's not only just the setting up, but like when they change email, parents change email addresses. You got to change it five different places. Yeah. You know, and that's just fine. Like we have a separate phone database that we don't, it's outside of RenWeb, but parents don't have to see that. you know, I only have to update it when I'm actually going to make an emergency call. Well, that's fine. The parents don't have to have an account. They don't have to know that it's a separate system. But if it's something they're going to have to log into, and they're probably going to log into once or twice, to me, it's just not worth it.
Yeah. Yeah, they're going to do it once a year. And that, and when you don't use something that often, it guarantees that you're going to have just a massive round of password resets and help, and people forgetting how to do it if you don't use it all the time. So, yeah, that kind of thing. Deal with that another way, I think.
Yeah, I mean, RenWeb has it built in. It's not the perfect thing, but it works. Mm-hmm. And we're not a 10,000-student school district.
Yeah, you don't have to scale up to that number. I mean, right. I'm aware of this, too, you know, that we do things at Cedars that would be unworkable in another in a school even twice the size of ours. But we get away with it because, you know, we're just small and it's fine and we can cope with it. And it, to me, it's insane to try and pretend to be a big school when you're not. You know, that, you know, a paper register that goes around to each of the four primary classrooms at the start of the morning is fine. Doesn't have to be any more than that. And if we were to, you know, we've looked at investing in, you know, SIMS or whatever, some of these, you know, fancy MIS systems, and we just don't use them because, you know, the cost of them is astronomical compared to the benefit we would get over, you know, our Google Drive approach that we have at the moment, which is free, you know, dead easy.
Well, no, you're exactly right, because it's not like if you say we're buying this system, well, our revenue is going to grow by 10%. It'll pay for itself. No, yeah. You're not getting any more revenue. It better be saving you. And that's really we don't do online enrollment and online re-enrollment through RenWeb. You know, we still send home paper copies. I turned in mine for my son yesterday, wrote a check, filled out a paper copy, initialed it. But the problem is RenWeb charges $20 per family, I think, for re-enrollment, and then $10 for online application. Now, that may be reversed. It's either 20 and 10 on one of the two. But the problem is that's just an expense for me. And so we have our school secretary who does a great job that when we get a re-enrollment contract, she goes into RenWeb and marks them for next year as pre-enrolled. Mm-hmm. And that when we change over to the new year, it just makes them enrolled. That's and puts it. Them in the right grade. Yeah. It's very, very, it takes literally 2 seconds per student. Well, if we switch to online enrollment or online re-enrollment, parents then have to figure out how to do that. They then have to pay online. We have to pay the credit card fees. Then we have to pay the $10 or $20 re-enrollment fee to RenWeb. And we're still paying the school secretary the same amount of money.
Yeah.
So it's just revenue lost.
Mm-hmm. And you know, unless your secretary is working to the absolute limit at all times, which is probably not true, with all respect to all school secretaries who work very hard, you know, there are jobs that come and go across the school year, and you know, there comes a time where that's, you know, that's a job you're focused on, and other things go by the wayside.
That's largely the way. Yeah. That's how our jobs are. I mean, there are times I'm a deployment specialist. There are times I'm a Mac hardware repair technician. You know, just because, you know, there are. I'm trying to think of an example. Like, just because I am busy some days, and it may be like I have a Mac that needs a hard drive swapped in. It's an old. Spinning disk MacBook Pro, and it'll take me 10 minutes to swap the drive outside of copying the data. I didn't have time today, but that doesn't mean because I didn't have time today, we needed to like outsource everything to a Mac reseller.
Yeah, no,
it's
exactly.
Like, just get to it tomorrow. I mean, and that to me goes back to playing your strengths as a small school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are so many of them. I mean, of course, there are disadvantages to being a small school. You've mentioned some of them already, but I really feel that. In some of these areas, you know, and in many ways, this is why we were able to do an iPad program when all you had to manage iPads was iTunes, was because I could literally brute force the entire deployment by sitting there one iPad at a time. And okay, it took me 4 hours, but, you know, it's only 4 hours. Whereas, you know, for a 2,000 people school, it would be weeks, you know, by comparison. And the consistency would never be there and difficult and so on. So, yeah, that's the nice thing about being a small school is you get to brute force problems that other people need automated tools and infrastructure and sometimes even custom tools built in order to get, you know, data migration done, for example.
Before we move on, let's thank our next sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Shobi. It's an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, teachers can quickly and easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads and then provide rich feedback to students by adding annotations, text notes, and voice notes directly onto documents. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of compatible iPad apps or by completing assignments with Shobi's built-in tools. Shobi keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, emails, and push notifications. Now, Shobi Basic is free for your all your teachers to start out with. They can get running today with their classroom, no cost. Go to Shobi.com or just go in the App Store and search for Shobi, S-H-O-W-B-I-E. But if you try Shobi and want a little bit more, they have Shobi Pro. And if you go to Shobi.com/out of school, and we'll have a link in the show notes, you can buy Shobi Pro for 5 year teachers and get 5 free for a whole year. So that's buy 5, get 5 free for a whole year. So thanks to Shobi for sponsoring the show this week.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk broadly about something else that I've been kind of looking into, which is it's kind of related to Shobi, although they're not. It's not really a competitor as such. Tools to do similar things on Google Drive. I'd spent some time last week looking at the course I teach in the Scottish system is called Administration in IT at the moment, and basically the way that all the assessment for that course works is you hand the students partially completed, or sometimes they generate new files by themselves, and they have to either, according to a set of instructions, they have to either change the file or change the database or make a new file or something like that. And one of the things I was looking at was, is it possible for me, at the moment I teach this using a Mac in Office, because some of the assessment specifications are very specific to Office. But I did an exercise where I looked at, I actually did by myself, I went through and I did all the exercises using just my Chromebook and Google Docs, and trying to figure out, is it possible to teach this course just using Google Docs and similar things? And I actually counted them up, how many outcomes, and could I do them or could I not do them? And 65% of it, yes, I could do it straightforwardly in Google Docs. 15% of it, I couldn't do because of certain missing features that had a workaround. And then the remainder were, I couldn't do it because the features weren't supported. And it was silly things like there are requirements to print out a spreadsheet showing formulas and row and column headings, and Google Sheets doesn't support printing with row and column headings or formulas. So that was a showstopper there. There's no real way around that. And then one of the things I was using instead of FileMaker Pro, which we use at the moment, is a new web app that's come out called Airtable, which is a kind of relational database website that you can make. You can upload, Excel files or CSVs that you export from FileMaker Pro and load them into Airtable and then build the relations in there. And Airtable is really, really nice. It's super easy to use, but it's missing a couple of features, that you can't have a report that goes across a join and actually show columns from both sides of the join yet. And that's no criticism of it, because it's actually not it's not fully shipped yet, but I was given access early. So it's shaping up to be a really nice replacement for FileMaker Pro if you want to do it based on the web. But as a result of all of this work, I came across these two tools called Doctopus and Gubrick, which to people who are kind of heavily embedded in the Chromebook world, I think this is going to be a wee bit like your kids telling you about the Beatles. Have you heard of these? This guy called Bob Dylan, because these tools, as far as I can tell, have been incredibly well adopted by the sort of Chromebook and Google Drive focused education community. And I'm just coming across them now, but I thought it would be worth, just having a little discussion about how they fit together and how you can use them alongside things like like iTunes U or even Google Classroom as well.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, so Doctopus and Gubrick are basically two add-ons for Google Docs, if you like. Doctopus is an add-on for Google Sheets, and Gubrick is a kind of extension that looks at what you're doing and can kind of help you in ways that I'll describe in a little minute. But basically, you start with Doctopus, right? And Doctopus will you open up a spreadsheet and you create your class roster in the spreadsheet, and that can be as simple as student's first name, second name, and their email address, which would typically be the one in your Google Apps domain. And then what you can do is you can create an assignment, and Doctopus will make folders for you. It will create folders in your Google Drive for the class, and then you'll have a shared view, which is a folder that all students can see whatever you put in there. And it will also create individual folders for all the students in the roster. And then once you've kind of got that all set up and going, what you can then do is you can say, well, here are some template files that need to be part of this assignment. And Doctopus will undertake to copy them for every student. There's different modes it can work in, but this is probably the most common one, would be to make a copy of that document for every student. The documents are still owned by you as a teacher, but then there'll be a copy for every student put in their folder, which is in your Google Drive still, and then shared with that student so they get it in their drive as well. And they now have editing permissions, and they can work in that document, and then you still have control over it and also access to it as they work on it as well. Make sense so far?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, this whole ecosystem that's building on top of Google Drive. And it kind of solves a lot of the problems we've talked about this episode in terms of like just continual other databases. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like Google's not too far away from being able to like build a student information system, you know, have a student information system built on top of Drive.
Yeah, I think what I'm starting to play with is I'm starting to play with the idea of being able to integrate things across Drive. And I think a lot of that gets pushed up into scripting and add-ons and things like that. There's not obvious point-and-click solutions for a lot of that stuff. But it's been interesting looking at what Doctopus can do. And I'm asking myself questions like, well, if you can write something as complicated as Doctopus as an add-on for Google Sheets, is it in theory possible that I could write an add-on that would print this sheet showing the formula, for example, and could I actually solve my problems, the lack of features in Google Docs by creating my own add-ons to make it possible to do my course in Google Docs? But that's probably a project for the summer rather than a project for right now. But the basic idea with Doctopus is once you've done that, you can share those documents with the students. They can work on them, and then when it comes time to mark them, you can do a thing where you basically freeze them for grading. So you remove the editing privileges from the students, and you can still grade them. And that's where Goobrick comes in. And Goobrick is a way to do rubric-based assessment on documents that you create and share through Doctopus. And it's really cool the way it works. I love what they've done with it because, you know, one of the issues when you're grading with a rubric is you've got to kind of have the rubric visible and the document at the same time. And if those are in two browser tabs or even two workbooks in the spreadsheet, you're constantly kind of flipping between each of them to, you know, look at the rubric description and then go back to the work and then go back to the rubric and make sure that your judgments are correct. And what Goobrick does is really cool because as Doctopus makes new documents for the students, it will put the URLs of those documents, the Drive URLs, into rows in the spreadsheet. And you can just click on them and it will take you straight to the student's response for that task. And once you've done that, using Doctopus, you can take a spreadsheet that has all your rubric descriptions in it and you can see here's the rubric for this assignment. And what happens then is once you open up that document, you can run the Goobrick extension. And what it does is it basically gives you a three-panel user interface where you can basically look at the document, look at the rubric, and work with the two together. I'm going to try and describe it to you what it looks like. If you imagine your browser window cut into quarters, then the lower three quarters is the Google Docs interface that you know and love. You're looking at the document, you've got the toolbar, the whole bit in a frame. And then across the top quarter, if you like, of your screen, it's divided into two. And on the left-hand side, you see, say, the four points of your rubric. Okay, so a 0, 1, 2, 3 rubric. You see, and you don't just see like the names of the things you're marking, but you actually get tabs for each area that you're marking. And then in the tab, you see the four, let's say, four different descriptors of each level of performance that you might see. So let's say I'm marking a report, okay? And one of the things I'm looking for is how well the spelling and punctuation has been done in the report. And there might be, you know, no spelling and punctuation mistakes or a small number or a large number or incoherent spelling and punctuation. And what I can do is as I'm reading the document, I can look at those four descriptions and I can actually just click on the one that I think applies to what I'm looking at. And that'll be recorded in the spreadsheet that's connected to this rubric. It's really cool because then instead of having to remember what the descriptors are or flip back and forth, you can just look and say, which of these four things I can see at the top of my screen matches what I see down here? And then just click on it and that's recorded and you can build up your marking of the rubric just as you go. And then on the other side of the top right, you've got a little panel where you can type freeform feedback to the student as well. And the beauty of it is that when you're done and you hit save, what happens is that all those marks that you've decided on go back into the spreadsheet so you can do class averages and so on. But it also takes a copy of the rubric that you've attached, and it inserts a table with the whole rubric into the bottom of the document, and it colors in the boxes where you've marked them certain things. So if you've given them a 3 for some points and a 2 for others and a 1 for others, those boxes will be colored in to show which of those 4 descriptors applies to the work that's been handed in. I think that was really cool. I was really impressed with it, and some of the things you can do with it were really cool.
Well, I think to me, one of the things that I like about this is a teacher could be, you know, they're not having to read then great, you know, or have, you know, it's all integrated into one. And so as they, you know, it kind of reminds me of if you had this ability, if you're, you know, you talked about when you're doing, watching presentations, like grading while you're watching them and being able to grade back and you watch back and grade them. It's kind of the same concept. You're kind of just saving yourself another step.
Yeah, I imagine you would get much better assessment judgments when you do that, rather than having to, you know, it's quite a high cognitive load, because I do this quite a lot where I've got, you know, the rubric is the first tab in the spreadsheet, and then I've got multiple other tabs for all the students, and I'm kind of flipping back and forth between one and the other to try and figure out what I'm trying to decide to do. So I can certainly see myself adopting Goobrick more often for some of the stuff that I do in Drive, and it's really cool. And one of the things I really like about it compared to Google Classroom is that all of your rubric marking decisions go back into the spreadsheet, so you can see them all in one place. Whereas Classroom, you can certainly grade whatever students hand in, but it doesn't collate it anywhere, like for the whole class. So your Google Classroom assignments are not connected to some kind of overall mark book that you might be keeping for the class elsewhere. So that was the main thing that I saw with Goobrick. I thought it was really cool. There's a number of things you can do as well, such as you can regrade if the student changes their work. You can regrade, and it will keep the first assessment decision in there, but it will add a second one below. You can also do things that leave audio comments, and that gets inserted as a link to a shared Google Drive file with the student as well, and also freeform text as well. So you can build up quite quickly, you know, and you can imagine if you've got a class of 30, let's say, going through that for each student is actually quite a fast process. And to go from one student's work to the next, you actually don't even have to leave the Goobrick UI. You can just say, you know, save and next, and it opens up the next student's work, resets the rubric, and you can start all over again. So you can really power through a lot of marking that way really nicely.
What does this cost?
This is free as far as I know. It's just in the add-ons screen. I know that the sort of commercial one we talked about with Tim Lauer last week, the commercial equivalent is Hapara Teacher Dashboard. Now, I don't know much about Hapara yet, so I'm going to look into that a little bit more. They are something like $4 per student per year, but Doctopus and Goobrick are free. They're made by an organization called New Visions for Public Schools in New York, and they are... They've really done a good job of making it as easy as possible to use, as easy as you can imagine something that sounds quite complicated. The way that they present it in the sidebar in Google Sheets is actually very straightforward. And once you kind of get it set up, you're well on your way to getting it done.
Well, yeah, it's you know, and theoretically, once you get it working, the only thing that can break it would be a huge update to Google Drive, you know, either Google Docs or Google Spreadsheets, but... If it's not built by like a one-off developer, you would think it would be well maintained.
Yeah, no, it seems to be, and they've also, since Google Classroom came out, they've added a way in which you can now set your assignment in Google Drive. Then you can kind of they call it ingesting. You can ingest it back into a Goobrick Doctopus setup, and then do the rest of it. So you still want to use Goobrick rather than Google Drive because it's such a nice grading interface. But you can actually adopt Classroom for the front end of it rather than having to push it out through Doctopus as well. So they are definitely putting in their new and additional features that I think, you know, people want to see, people who are moving over to Classroom. Because one of the things I think is interesting with Classroom is that it enables the student to create new things and insert it as part of their hand into the teacher. Whereas as far as I could see so far, which is not, I haven't been into it in tons of detail, and I'd like feedback from any listeners who use this on a regular basis, but it wasn't clear to me that the student could provide another file to you through Doctopus, and then you could still get the same grading experience. As far as I could tell, it sort of had to be the file that Doctopus made for the student would then be accessible in Goobrick. So I'd like feedback on that. If people know the answer to that, can you say I had the students make a video in iMovie and then upload it to Google Drive? Could I grade that in Goobrick in the same way that I could if I had shared a Google Doc with them in the first place?
Before we move on, let's thank our last sponsor of the night, it's the fine folks at Jamf Software. You know them. They're the makers of the great Apple-focused mobile device management system. It's called the Casper Suite. It works with Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs in your schools and your businesses. They have a great app called Casper Focus that allows teachers from their iPad to take control of their deployment in their classroom. They can initiate AirPlay. They can distribute iBooks. They can conduct secure exams within an app. And then they can quickly gain a student's attention by taking control of their iPads. So if you have iPads, have Macs in your school, and want to have better management of them, go to outofschool.net, and we'll have a special link to go visit jampsoftware.com. Thanks to Jamf for sponsoring the show this week. Well, no, this whole ecosystem on top of Drive is interesting, just because we're already using that. And it's not even that it's Drive, it's like the authentication scheme.
Yeah, that's a big part of it, isn't it? You know, if you can work with it through your Google logins. And that was one of those things that was nice about, I mentioned Airtable earlier on, the database program, takes Google logins. So, you know, I could just get in there and start working straight away, which is really nice.
Well, we'll wrap up there. Next week, we'll have a special guest, first-time guest, and I think you guys are going to love his perspective on iPad and day-to-day use. So we'll leave that surprise dangling mm-hmm. out there. But yeah. Again, my name is Bradley Chambers. I'm at chambersdaily.com on the web. And if you don't follow me on Twitter, please do. And I would love to connect with you. I love connecting with listeners and you know, hearing what you do. And it's like, that's one of the things I love about Twitter. I was telling someone today that, you know, it's so great that you can tweet something and get 10 responses back in 10 minutes with, you know, answers for questions. So I'd love to connect with any listeners. So I'm Bradley Chambers on Twitter.
Yep. And I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter, where my question today was, does anybody know why the Google Drive apps on iOS are not showing the proper files that I've got in my drive? And it turns out you've seen that, I've seen that, and quite a few other people have as well. So sometimes I just use Twitter as a way to confirm that what I'm seeing is a bug and not actually just me being insane, which is a very, very useful feature. So I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web. And we'll catch you next week.